live from the JLE in London, you're listening to History for the Curious, the podcast. 20 minutes with Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch, hosted by myself, Menat Reisner. Join us as we cross continents, sail through the centuries, tracing lives, uncovering events, and following epic journeys to reveal the untold stories and the mysteries that have impacted our history and shaped us into who we are today. Good evening, Rabbi Hirsch. Welcome back to the final episode in the French Revolution. We covered the period from 1789 to 1799 over the last two episodes, and that was chaos. We saw its effect on the Jews. We then continued into the reign of Napoleon, and we left off last week with the very antagonistic 12 questions that he asked the Jews in the early 1800s.
Right. So we mentioned that Napoleon was determined to shape domestic policy in France, and in 1806 he turned his attention to the Jews. The decision to convene the Assembly of Jewish Notables was really because of a fateful meeting in January 1806 between Napoleon and non-Jewish farmers in Strasbourg following the Emperor's return from Austerlitz, and he is persuaded by them that their poverty is the result of heavy debts to Jewish moneylenders. And Napoleon came to view the Jews as the vilest of all nations, and that exceptional legal measures were necessary in order to put an end to Jewish usury and to the humiliation of the French nation, which, by the way, was against the nearly unanimous opposition of his own legal advisers. I mean, we have a report to the emperor from his own minister of religions, who conceded that it may not have been advisable to proclaim them citizens without investigating if they could, or even if they wanted sincerely to become so. It's a bit late for that now. So anyway, Napoleon creates the Sanhedrin, which is this name, which was there really to pressure Jewish leaders by having them appear in public under the spotlight. And the process unfolded in two stages. June 1806, an assembly was called, made up 50% laymen, 50% rabbis. There were 112 delegates in all. And he asks them the 12 questions that we mentioned last week, which includes the Jewish attitude to intermarriage, the status and power of the rabbis of the Beis Din. And basically, the delegates are made aware that obtaining full citizenship depended on how they answered these questions about the competing demands of state versus religion, given that halacha would seem to contradict French citizenship requirements.
It's a bit confusing, this whole thing. It's like a big carrot that he's giving, but with this stick in the background.
Well, this stick becomes even more visible because on the 30th of May, supposedly in the belief that government intervention was necessary in order to restore economic stability in Alsace, Napoleon issued an imperial decree which declared a freeze on all debts owed to Jews by farmers in the northeast. In other words, no one pays Jews what they owe them, which is basically to pressure the Jews to turn up on the 15th of July. And therefore, by August, Napoleon had his 12 answers, and I will quote three of them. In the second question, is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? Is divorce valid when not pronounced by non-Jewish courts of justice, or is it in contradiction with those of the French code? The answer, divorce is allowed by the law of Moses, but it is not valid if it isn't previously pronounced by the French code. In the eyes of every Israelite, submission to the prince is the first of duties, so you have to have a secular divorce first. Third question, can a Jewess marry a Christian and a Jew marry a Christian woman, or does the law allow the Jews to marry only amongst themselves? Answer, the law doesn't say that a Jewess cannot marry a Christian, nor a Jew a Christian woman, nor does it state that the Jews could only marry amongst themselves. The only marriages expressly forbidden by the law are those with the seven Canaanite nations and with Ammon and Moab. The opinion of the rabbis is against these marriages. According to them, since marriage, according to the Talmud, requires religious ceremonies called kiddushin, and no marriage can be religiously valid unless these ceremonies have been performed, so it can't be done when marrying outside the faith. Eighth, and the last question I'm going to share, what police jurisdiction do rabbis exercise amongst the Jews? What judicial power do they enjoy? The answer, rabbis exercise no manner of jurisdiction amongst the Jews. Now, clearly, these answers are being very economical with the truth. Yes, the Torah doesn't explicitly mention in the written law that intermarriage is forbidden, but the entire oral law is replete with it, as is every halachic work ever written in the last 1,000 years without exception. And the idea that rabbis exercise no authority over the Jews is now saying Beis Din will from now on only be advisory or voluntary.
Who are all these delegates? I mean, you said there were laymen, you said there were rabbis. Do we know who they were?
You mean why would they have agreed to these answers? Yeah. So it's complicated. In terms of the rabbinate, Reb David Zinsheim was the president, the head of this assembly, and then subsequently of Napoleon's Sanhedrin, which we haven't got to yet. He was an eminent Talmud Chacham and the spiritual leader of Alsacian Jewry. And after he finished going through the Talmud for the third time, he starts writing his magnum opus, the Yad Dovid, which appears on almost every tractate of Shas. And he's also got leadership qualities. In 1789, several petitions were sent to Paris bearing his signature. In September 1791, when the Jews of Bischheim were requested to pledge allegiance to the country in a manner that was offensive to their religion, Rabbi Zinsheim succeeded to have the procedure altered to the satisfaction of the Jews despite fierce opposition by local authorities. But in 1805, he gives a sermon in the synagogue of Strasbourg praising Napoleon's victories on the European battlefields. The great Napoleon, our emperor, our king. I mean, obviously, this is prior to Napoleon acting against the Jews, and it was felt at the time that he was still a friend of the Jews. So he is chosen to lead. But the delegates include the broadest type of Jews, even of rabbis. And the obvious differences about religion became apparent already at the first meeting of the assembly, because it took place on July 26, 1806, which was a Shabbos. The liberal delegates, they ride to the assembly and they write down their votes to elect the members of a steering committee. The more religious delegates, they walk and they had written down their votes on the preceding day. Now, Rav Zinsheim is entrusted to prepare the answers which are going to be presented to Napoleon. And you have an echo of these debates between the liberals and the traditionals in a letter that he wrote to Rvietlis of Prague, where he is very critical of his colleagues for their superficial knowledge of Judaism. And he complains that he is alone in carrying the burden of the answers to these 12 questions, understanding the weight that's on his shoulder, and in resisting those members who want to basically distort halacha.
I'm surprised that Napoleon gave the 12 questions in advance, almost giving them warning and time to prepare very, as you said before.
He wasn't trying to catch them out. He wants them to confirm these answers. And that's why he will convene the Sanhedrin after the Assembly of Notables, basically a year later. He's not interested in finding out what the halacha says. Whether he knew or not that halacha is contrary to his questions, it's quite possible.
On that point, I mean, you said before they were economic with the truth. I mean, some of the things that were answered were simply untrue.
Okay, so let's take the answers that I mentioned. Regarding marriage and divorce needing secular approval, it was basically resolved there and then that in order to get citizenship, that's what they would do moving forward, that secular legal marriage and divorce would precede chuppah and kiddushin. And therefore, from then on, a French Jew would only be able to marry under a chuppah if they already had a marriage certificate from the country they were in.
which is what we do today.
Exactly. So it's not new to us. It's new in 1806. And it doesn't contradict halacha. I mean, mostly. Okay, a 15-year-old still won't be able to marry. But, you know, also, inasmuch as non-Jews were subject to the Noahide laws, so the practice of lending money at interest towards them could be said to be prohibited.
But what about the marriage to non-Jews? I mean, that was clearly a...
A sham answer.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Here, basically, what we're looking at is a question that is so obvious that everybody knows the truth. And those that want to assimilate, they're going to go ahead and do so. In other words, it's such a loaded question that everyone knows the true answer and they're either interested in Judaism or not. So you've got nothing to lose by giving that answer. It's a... in a way, an all-out strategy, but it is a particular case which is so self-evident to every Jew.
Right. I just find it surprisingly halachically that one can even in public say something like that. Obviously, he had broad halachic shoulders.
He's not saying anything which is untrue. He's just not opening the entire corpus of halacha, which is Torah Baal Peh. Right. Okay. At the opening session of the Sanhedrin, he actually publicly created a tefillah in Lashon Kodesh, which in English translates as, or part of it, as we gather to seek knowledge and learn what people of Israel must do, send us your holy advice, so that we may not stray left or right from the path of your commandments. Keep our eyes from seeing untruth, save us from error. He's aware of the problems facing him. Avrom Deutsch, who was a former chief rabbi of Strasbourg, writes that this tefillah is penetrated with a genuine sadness and intensity felt by Rav Zinsheim. Now, in September, Napoleon proceeds to step two, the Sanhedrin, which ends up meeting between February and April 1807. And as I mentioned, the purpose is to get the rabbis to publicly agree to that which has been decided. But even at the Sanhedrin, you know, the rabbis there include the most liberal, especially since by then Napoleon's victories included parts of Germany and Italy, all of whom sent representatives to Paris. And that settles the matter. Yet, in 1808, Napoleon issued what is known as the infamous decree, which continues to limit strongly the rights of Jews in collecting debts. It's a very hostile act. And on that very same day, he issues an additional decree to centralize the Jewish rabbinic community of France, which should now be overseen by regional consistoires. Right, the consistoire was the only authority from then on that would administer internal Jewish affairs. It would represent Jewish interests to the government. And according to Article 12, I quote, it was to ensure that rabbis offer no interpretation of the law that failed to conform to the Sanhedrin's decision and were to make certain that no prayer assembly was formed without express authorization. And basically from there, it's pretty much downhill. You know, by 1839... the Central Consistoire proposed a plan, it didn't go through, but they proposed to reorganize the constitution, and it would give lay members the ultimate authority in religious matters, and I quote again, it would grant the consistory exclusive power to make ritual reforms as it saw fit and to determine which prayer books and textbooks would be used in synagogues and schools. Rabbis were believed to be the major obstacle to reform. If rabbinic authority could be brought under control, ritual and synagogue reform would be implemented more effectually. So it opened the door to all of this. And at the same time, Rav Zinsheim himself was compelled by Napoleon to become the first sort of chief rabbi of France and forced to reside in Paris. And he expresses regret that he had to abandon Strasbourg, be separated from his extensive library and the yeshiva. And he dies in Paris in November 1812. The Chassam Sofer gave a Hesped, a eulogy for him, and praised him as having earned the respect of the emperor and his ministers, yet didn't allow others to rule over him. Although others were more reserved in their praise, you know, without mentioning him by name, they took issue with the decision of the Sanhedrin. They said, you know, you're reconciling halacha to Napoleon. But the truth is that the Sanhedrin would have taken place either way, and Napoleon absolutely intended defining the status of citizenship for everybody, including the Jews, one way or the other. Basically, all in all, this outcome is it's not reform, but it's government-sponsored orthodoxy. And, you know, maybe we have to do a future podcast on 19th century France, talk about Rothschild, who was the richest person in France, not the richest Jew, about religious issues and obviously the lead up to Dreyfus. You know, wow. So
yeah. Napoleon was, I mean, would you call him an anti-Semite?
Yes.
It's funny because you ask the average person on the street.
He has such a good reputation, yes. Yeah. Because he helped the emancipation of the Jews and gave them full citizenship.
Yet with strings attached.
And it was more than that. He railroaded it through.
Right. So maybe back in those days, even allowing them to be citizens, I guess.
As we mentioned last week, you know, yeah.
You promised in episode one a sting in the tail, as you
said. I did.
We're now at the sort of at the end of part three. We're still waiting patiently.
For the sting. Well, yeah. It's in the tail. We shall do that now. Okay. For once, we will follow not the history of events, but the history of the documents that recorded these events. In part one, I mentioned that not much is written about the 10 years of the revolution. So where were my sources from? Well, probably 40% comes from one individual, either directly or from his archives. Thousands of documents on French Jewry ended up in the United States during the second half of the 20th century. And the story of how and why this material came to the States is simple. The historian Zosha Tchaikovsky, although he never had a degree, and he never held a permanent academic post, he wrote scores of articles in the field, mostly on topics that no one had ever researched before. And Tchaikovsky was a passionate collector and dealer in French Judaica. And between 1940 and 1961, he acquired tens of thousands of documents of historical interest about French Jews. Some were taken during the war, others in the chaos following liberation, but many, probably the majority, were taken in the 1950s. And after acquiring them, he brought them to New York, where he used them to create his articles. And later he sold them to American research libraries, where often they still are to this day. So far, so good. Except that in 1961, his methods of acquiring these files were uncovered. He was stealing them.
Was stealing thousands of papers?
More or less, yes. Okay, a little background. Sting in the tail, I did say. Tchaikovsky was born in 1911 as Yeshua Friedman to a poor Jewish family in the Polish town of Zarom in 1911. And by his own account, he had very little in the way of formal education. He attended a Yiddish language secular primary school as a boy, and then he was in Warsaw for a while, and he arrives in Paris in 1927 and enters the scene of non-religious Yiddish-speaking intellectuals. The historians in that circle were connected to the YIVO, which in Paris was headed by Elia Cherikova. The main branch of YIVO was in Vilna. And when the war broke out, most of the members of the French YIVO fled to New York, including the Cherikovas, in autumn 1940. And the YIVO was being reconstructed there. But they couldn't take all of their material with them, so they entrusted it to Tchaikovsky, who then actually joined the French Foreign Legion and was wounded in battle and was convalescing in Carpentras in the southern France. And he promises that he would take care of the papers for them. And from Carpentras, he acquires various objects. I mean, how he gets them, we are not totally aware, but it wouldn't be a stretch to say that he lifted them, you know, unannounced. He gets a Megillus Esther, a Keser Torah crown, a synagogue bris chair, and he sends them all to the YIVO in New York as donations for their collection. In fact, in late 1940, he sends them a Sefer Torah. It was his way of proving to them that he was worth saving because he's the only one in France who cares about the archives. And his pleading works because from the moment of their arrival in New York, the Cherikovas work tirelessly, pulling every string possible to get him one of the, you know, few coveted visas being issued after France is already occupied by the Nazis. And he gets out of Marseille in 1941. But it's not long before he returns to Europe, because in January 43, Tchaikovsky joins the US Army and is assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division as a paratrooper and an interpreter. He's a very colourful life. And when he's in France in 1944, during when he's on leave, he recovers part of the archive that he'd left behind. And he writes that he didn't believe that France was a secure place for Jewish archives going forward. In the summer of 45, he is reassigned to Allied occupied Germany. Now, in France, he focused on material produced by Jews. In Germany, he develops a passion for anti-Semitic books. And shortly after he gets there, there is an order from the Allied command that makes these books illegal. They didn't want German citizens holding on to these books, and that they would be subject to confiscation or destruction. So he has to get them out. And in order to get them out and fit them into packages, he decides to rip out the chapters of interest from their binding and send them on. And he writes to them, "Am I a barbarian to do that?" So he answers himself, "Probably, but it's the only way. I can't send the books intact. They'd be lost in any case. So I'm doing my barbaric work with a clean conscience. Aside for that, is it ever barbaric to rip apart Nazi books? A German girl saw as I sat and tore pages out of a Nazi book and started crying. Her beastly Nazi soul couldn't bear seeing a Jew calmly tearing out pages of a German Nazi book."
How long did he stay in Europe?
Well, by 1946, he was at the YIVO in New York as an archivist and researcher, and he's there for the next 30 years. But throughout the 1950s, he is traveling, and he publishes an average of 7 articles a year, all based on original research, primarily on the Jews in France in the 18th and 19th centuries. But on one of his research trips to France, he is caught red-handed by the Strasbourg Municipal Archives. He said to them, "You know, my time in the city is limited and there's a lot to be seen." So he asked permission to stay late after the archives closed. This was, in particular, the evening of April 13th, 1961. So, as they often did for researchers, the archivist locked up, but let him take the documents across the hall to the municipal library, which is in the same building. At around 6:30 p.m., a librarian there sees him tearing pages out of a volume of documents that are bound. And she opens his briefcase and she finds others. She calls the head, Philip Doninger, who, together with the concierge, accompanies Tchaikovsky back to his room at the Hotel Royal, where they got hold of another 73 documents and 21 pamphlets, all of which he's stolen from the archives, and some of which are now torn out of books. And in the morning, he's gone. He escaped across the border to Germany during the night. And so the hotel room is now raided by the police. They find another 70 documents. And these are not just from Strasbourg. He had materials from Bordeaux, Avignon, Carpentras, Aix-en-Provence, Marseille, Metz, Paris. And these were the towns that he'd visited, not just then, but in 1950, in 1955. So they realised that he'd been stealing for a long time.
But you said he was gone in the morning. Why didn't they arrest him as soon as they saw him that night and just kept him under guard?
Okay, so the chief librarian, this guy called Doninger, believed that Tchaikovsky was basically a poor, struggling historian who'd made a mistake in judgment. He didn't see him as a, you know, habitual thief of tens of thousands of documents. But nevertheless, the city of Strasbourg decided it wasn't worth the expense of extraditing him. So he was convicted of theft in absentia and sentenced to 3 years in prison and fined 5,000 francs. So he never returns to France. And that ends his career as a collector of French Judaica. But fascinatingly, there is a sort of mythology which is connected to the Holocaust that clung to this story in the Jewish archives, because rumors circulated questioning what, you know, was a straightforward story of theft. And we sort of catch a glimpse of those rumors in the local newspaper report about the incident, which said, I quote, "If we're to believe what we hear in certain parts of Strasbourg, the thief was no stranger. It seems that this person might be a certain historian who answers to the name of Friedman of Polish origin. He had two accomplices, Sosza and Tarkowski. They believe, maybe with too much haste, that the three men who weren't arrested were looking to fill out the dossier for the Eichmann trial. And it's quite hard to say if this is the case." Now, why the Eichmann trial? Because the idea was being floated that Israel was sending agents all over Europe to put together evidence for the Eichmann trial, stealing the documents. And the Eichmann trial started 2 days before his arrest on the 11th of April. But actually, the documents he'd stolen were all from the 18th century. It had nothing to do with Nazi crimes. And they turned Tchaikovsky into a gang of three, Friedman, Sosza, and Tarkovsky. And that way, a simple theft became a sort of, you know, a Zionist conspiracy. And archive hunting is now part of the Jewish struggle for justice and revenge. So you can, you know, create stories out of nothing.
He sounds like he was a real intellectual. Yeah. How does he sort of justify the theft of this, you know, lowly thief running around Europe?
He has no problem. As far as he's concerned, taking materials relevant to Jewish history from one country to another was simply because the Jews have now moved from one country to another because they had to look for safe haven. And the history of the Jews has to be written by Jews, wherever they live. And in this view, you know, countries are not the owners of the story, even if they own the documents which are necessary for writing the story. It's the Jews who've got a legitimate claim on the archives to write that story. You know, from, I don't know, 1956 onwards, he's selling large quantities of material to JTS in New York, to Hebrew Union College, all over.
Just thinking with his theory, the British Museum would probably be empty.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
So you're saying that he sold all these quantities of material, yep, and these thousands of documents. Did the buyers know that it was stolen?
I mean, pretty much.
How
does this one guy have them all? You know, his business is dependent on the existence of buyers for his stolen stuff. And in most cases, they basically look the other way. And their reasoning is related to the one that I've just mentioned, because in the United States, his actions are seen in a very different light, meaning that by the end of World War II, Judaica librarians in America think of their libraries as the preservers of the European Jewish past that has basically been destroyed or almost destroyed. And therefore, you know, post-World War II, post-Holocaust, the USA and Israel are the rightful places, in fact, the only places, as far as they're concerned, for these documents, and especially in America, because, so to speak, if not for us, all of Europe's Jewish written history would have been destroyed anyway. So, you know, this is a sense of mission, which, you know, also existed in other places. In Brandeis University, there was a guy called Victor Birch. And, you know, he's very moved when Tchaikovsky told him that the materials had been found in one of the boxcars, in one of the cattle wagons that he had found when he was in the US Army. But how much material could he have found there? And how much material could he have moved from there on his own? I mean, you know, please. But they were happy to get rare materials for their library. And in fact, in the post-war, almost obsessive move toward expansion through acquisition resulted firstly in poor cataloguing, in poor preservation and accessibility, and in one way was quite tragic because inadequate facilities contributed to the devastating effect of the fire in 1966 that destroyed or damaged 170,000 books, including irreplaceable items, the Sifrei Torah that the Kehillah of Danzig, the Jewish community there, had sent to JTS in 1938 for safekeeping when their library was taken over by the Nazis. All of these were, you know, gone.
So what did he do after 1961? Was he able to continue his activities in any way?
Activities of writing, yes, activities even of selling, but now he was using his own previously stolen items, which were still in his own domain, so to speak, and he breaks them up into parts because if you sell pieces, you avoid suspicion on the part of the buyers or, you know, alleged suspicion.
And you get more money.
Yes, yeah, that's the main reason. It netted him much higher profits because buyers are going to pay more if you sell each piece by piece to single buyers than you would for a whole collection. And he sold to anyone, you know, not just libraries, a range of people and institutions, dealers, private collectors, but with negative effect, because by selling them piecemeal to different parts of the country, he knew what had been sold and where it was, and he was able to, you know, cite these materials when he writes an article. But for any other scholar, this is an impossibility. Their documents now spread all over the United States. How are you going to follow the trail? It becomes very messy.
It's a bizarre tale. You have this lone ranger with stolen documents just running around selling them.
Right. I
mean, how long could he get away with this madness for?
Okay, so now the last sting, quite literally, in the tale. In September 1978, Tchaikovsky is found dead. A few days earlier, he'd been arrested outside of New York Public Library in an organized police sting operation. He'd been using the library for decades and the staff knew him, but one evening, a librarian on duty at the reference desk saw that he had a very large volume propped up in front of him while he's working on other materials. And somebody else in the library catches the librarian's eye and tells her that, you know, there's something wrong here. And, yep, he's stealing again, this time from a collection of pamphlets that had been bound together into volumes. And the librarians checked the volumes. They saw that pamphlets had been removed systematically, you know, by knife or by scissors. He had literally no compunctions. And so the next time he comes to the library, which might have even been the next day, they stop him. They demand to look in his briefcase, and they found rare pamphlets. They arrested him. They locked him up. This time they did lock him up overnight. And in the morning, they go back to the apartment. They search for additional materials. I presume they had a warrant by then, and they find nothing. And they learn why, because he had already sold his stuff to Harvard University Library. And he'd obviously cut off all the ownership stamps before selling it on. So you've got all these pieces, you know, books where the front page has a bit missing. And therefore, to go back to your question, did the people know? Well, how come the place where you would have expected, you know, some sort of stamp, there's nothing there? But now that he'd been caught, he couldn't hide what had happened to him from his employers at Evo, and they'd have to fire him, and he'd lose his access to libraries. So he is now shamed, he's disgraced, he's exposed publicly as a thief. And on September the 26th, 1978, he drowned himself in the bathtub of a hotel room in Midtown Manhattan. And his funeral, his levaya, brought out many scholars and librarians, mostly Jewish, with whom he'd worked for three decades in New York. And Arthur Herzberg, who's a very famous historian, delivered the eulogy in Yiddish.
Would you say that his motives were entirely intellectual or trying to preserve a piece of history? Or maybe he was just a common thief who saw a big niche?
I would say that his motives evolved over time, which, you know, makes it difficult to categorize his behavior. It's almost certain that during wartime, his illegal transfers were a rescue effort, and he saw it as such, and the alternative is to fall into the hands of the Nazis. It's justifiable under, you know, possibly even in halacha, as a valiant response to the catastrophe of war and the Holocaust. Even post-war, 45, in different places, potentially. But by 1961, you know, he's a serial thief in the 50s and the early 60s.
Once he got greedy.
Yeah.
We're grateful for his bravery and his thievery, so that at least we caught a glimpse of our history that we would never have known.
I'm not sure that we wouldn't have known it, because the stuff
they
that
would
he
have
was
eventually gotten exposed.
In
right.
the 50s and the 60s, who was, you know, what else was going to happen to them? No one was going to burn them.
Right. So, you know. Okay, that was the sting.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Roy. That was a fantastic episode as always. And yes, I've said it before and I sound like a broken record, but I didn't know much about the French Revolution at all.
Right, yes, you and the rest of the world out there almost.
Beginning till the end. I mean, France is not a... people go to Paris nowadays. I don't know if it's on the layman's historical route to go to France. It's just...
Okay.
I'm assuming the tourist industry will be booming post this podcast.
Absolutely. Although for the next series, I'm going to try and also bring out the unknown in an area which is much more known about. We're going to deal with the rumbum, but things that we do not know or that the average individual doesn't know. Fez, his time there. Whom did he label a befuddled novice? And who was Zuta the Rosha?
All to be found out next week.
Over the next couple of sessions, yes.
Looking forward. Thank you, Rabbi Hirsch. Please subscribe to on whatever platform you're listening on. Subscribe so that you don't miss another episode. Also subscribe so that other people can find it. The more followers, the more easy it is for people to find. Give it a 5-star review if you enjoyed it. Please keep sending it on. And we always like receiving your feedback and your questions and your suggestions to podcasts@jle.org.uk. Have a good night.